This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3539 for Thursday the 24th of February 2022. Today's show is entitled, Linux In-Laws S01E50, the Open SUSE project and is part of the series, Linux In-Laws. It is the 50th show of Monochrome, and is about 68 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, an interview with Doug DeMayo and Axel Braun from the Open SUSE project.
Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35, or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs. Welcome to Linux In-Laws. Season 1258, episode I can't remember. Barton, how are things?
Oh, things are great. I think it's episode 1,200,000.
Yes, something like that.
42.
Today we have very special guests. It's the Open SUSE project that was kind enough to donate some time to us. But without further ado, why don't the two guests on our show introduce themselves? Let me start with you, Doug.
Yeah, so I'm Douglas DeMayo. I've been with the project since 2016. I basically do events, marketing, PR, just a variety of different things for the project. And I also manage the Open SUSE conference and liaison with the company and manage the budget and other things. So that's kind of what I do for Open SUSE. I'm the go-to person for a lot of things.
Excellent.
Yeah, my name is Axel Braun. I got in contact with SUSE at that point in time. I think it was around 1998. I'm an Open SUSE contributor since 2000 somewhat. The year of the Linux desktop is for me actually since 1998. That was the time when I switched completely to Linux. And my focus is making it usable for non-technical persons. So I'm mostly packaging software to make it usable on OpenSUSE, and I'm on the OpenSUSE board since about 3 years now.
A board member that still does packaging. I'm impressed.
Well, yeah, why not? All kind of contributions are welcome, and the OpenSUSE board is not something like a board of directors or something like that.
But before we go any further, maybe for the two people on listening to this episode who do not know what OpenSUSE is, maybe we should shed some more light on this.
Okay. So OpenSUSE is a community project that was founded around 2005, I think. By our main sponsor, of course, by SUSE. And we still have a very close relationship to SUSE. So this is a commercial company. They are funding their money on open source software. And we are sharing a lot of values, of ideas, and of course, technology. The latest move that we did was that the OpenSUSE Leap, which is a classical release model is now sharing the binaries with SUSE Linux Enterprise. So what you basically get is SUSE Linux Enterprise without a subscription fee.
Excellent, excellent. Axel, but our Dag, before we go further, SUSE the company, maybe not everybody knows it. What is it and how it came about? What is the purpose behind this company? Maybe you can share some light on the history of things.
Yeah, so I mean, the company really started out in the beginning of the days of when Linus started with the kernel, and it really started off as a translation company, so just a contributor base, and then eventually it had moved into creating, I believe it was Slackware. The company's been around longer than like any of the other companies pretty much. And you know, that's kind of why you often hear that people will say that SUSE was there first. But it started out based on the translations, you know, before Red Hat.
Even longer than Red Hat. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. And it started from four guys. Matter of fact, one of them, I think he's still with the company. But you know, a few of them have gone on and done different things in their life. And actually one of the fellow board members works with one of the founders for a different company, Datto. But so they create open source software dealing with the distribution. They work in obviously creating tools and for configuration management and, you know, tools for, you know, helping to build the distribution. You have the open build service, which you might be familiar with, which, you know, that's sort of the open SUSE project. And they also have the internal build service. So SUSE uses that. You know, they share open QA, which is a quality assurance for distribution. But yeah, they recently kind of got involved with the whole container aspect. You could probably see that through the purchase of Rancher and bringing them on board. And so yeah, they're all over.
So it's a company older than Red Hat and still being active. I understand if I remember this correctly, they floated 2019 or 2020, some flutters, didn't they?
So they were purchased by Novell. This was, oh, I don't know. I guess it was somewhere in the early 2000s. And then, you know, they've gone through some transition of being purchased by companies. I think from Novell, it got purchased by Attachmate. And from there, it got purchased by Micro Focus. And then it's purchased by a fund. And from there, then they floated on the stock market. And now it's kind of back to where it was when it started off a little bit, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's had a long road. But we're back to where we started.
But back to the open source project. So the relationship is somewhat comparable, say, to Red Hat and Fedora? Or more like Red Hat and CentOS, when it still was independent and not part of this, what was called IBM?
Yeah, I think it's comparable. It's comparable. The open source project itself, so OpenSUSE, is more or less independent, although we do not have a legal structure behind. This is something that is in discussion already for longer. For example, KDE is a EV, an eingetragener Verein. This is a charitable kind of organization in Germany. Or the Document Foundation, who's publishing LibreOffice, is a foundation, a Stiftung. And we are actually thinking about something similar, but if it's not driven from community, hang on, that was my phone, sorry for that. If it's not driven by community, the board itself will probably not push for it.
Okay. Right.
So it's a support structure for sure. You need that those elements, I think, for the open source, for an open source community to function as a nonprofit. And Fedora finds themselves in very similar situations as well. So we actually have a lot of cross collaboration with them because there's a lot of similarities between the two.
It's an RPM-based distribution as well, right? But before we go into the low-level details, Martin, what's on your mind?
Yeah, with all open-source projects, it's kind of my question is always, what do people do in their daytime, right? How is the people that build OpenSUSE, how are they earning their money, or are they, you know, there's got to be some people that work for SUSE, the company, I imagine, but presumably there's also a large number that contribute to OpenSUSE from different purposes. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's right. Many of the SUSE employees are also contributing to OpenSUSE for some reason as well, because SUSE has also a so-called factory first policy. And for this, I need to explain a little bit how the OpenSUSE distribution is built. Sure. So we have a repository, let's call it, that's called Factory, and all new software has to be submitted into Factory. From Factory, snapshots are taken, being tested in OpenQA, and if the test is positive, then this snapshot is released as a new Tumbleweed release. Tumbleweed is basically our rolling release, which is updated at a maximum once per day. So this is comparable to Arch Linux, for example, with the big difference that our rolling release is tested. So you can imagine if you have a new kernel with proprietary NVIDIA drivers or a new glibc or something like that, the one or the other thing may not work ad hoc, so it needs a little bit adjustment. And this all comes up, or for the most part, comes up in our OpenQA testing. And maybe this is the reason that the amount of unique users of OpenSUSE has increased in the last year. I think it's nearly doubled. So that means as well, if there is new software for SUSE Linux Enterprise, it goes through Factory as well.
Now, Axel, some people may have a different opinion about testing. Because
some, as a some people about maintain Arch packages, perhaps.
Exactly. Full disclosure, I'm an Arch package maintainer. So it's, I'm an Arch user repository package maintainer, I might add. So, for example, there's this alarm distribution. This alarm distribution was created specifically to port Arch to the ARM processor family, and they use a high level of automation, basically not only for building the packages but also QAing the packages once they've come down from upstream, as in the original. Core extra and community repos. Just to stick to that example, so they're doing that as well.
Yeah, I think in between Fedora is also adapting our OpenQA system for automated testing. Right, Doug, are you aware of that?
They are doing that. KDE uses it as well. And GNOME. I mean, they
GNOME. GNOME rings a bell in that context. Yes.
Yeah.
Even before systemd aligns, but that's a different story.
And I do believe there are some people from Debian using it as well. Is it Cubis OS, I think? They do it. You bump into people, you know, all over the place. Not for the past couple of years, right, since we haven't had so many events, but you'll bump into people constantly who are using the tools. I mean, that's one thing about OpenSUSE is we're really open to the idea of anyone just, you know, like being a part of the whole ecosystem, you know, like if we have a tool and, you know, we think it's useful for people, I mean, here you go, you know, just use it and contribute to it. I mean, because that's how the whole ecosystem works.
Okay. Martin, sorry, you wanted to add something.
Well, the other thing I wanted to know is really about the fact that around OBS, right, that seems to be quite a differentiator, if I'm not mistaken. Being able to build other distros.
Right. Yeah, I must say, Open Build Service was, for me, one of the key parts to join this or to stay with the community. I mean, as I said in the beginning, I think my first contact with SUSE was around 1998. And in between, I think I tried nearly every distribution, but I always returned because not only of this nice community, but as well because OpenSUSE really makes it easy for you to package software for different releases, for different distributions, and as well for different architectures. If you ever tried this the classic way that you have to set up a build environment for, let's say, Leap and Tumbleweed and maybe for Debian and something like that, then you know what amount of work that is. And with the Open Build Service, it's more or less a keystroke, right? Then you can, for example, build for Arch for ARM processors as well.
What are the usual CPU architectures that you support apart from Intel? I remember ARM, SV5, V6, V7, V8. At least V7, V8, if I'm completely mistaken.
So I could kind of go back to a little bit of what Martin had brought up, you know, with the whole ecosystem and how people work in it. That kind of goes along the lines of that question that you have as well. So you'll see that we have the ARM ecosystem, you know, ARM 7. You know, we did a survey last year about that, you know, ARM 8. We have in the OBS, I believe we just got a few Power 9 machines, Power PC, mainframe, so 390X.
S390, yeah. RISC-V.
RISC-V, yeah. I mean, so it's if you just go to the Open Build Service, you'll see all the different architectures it's building for. And we have people that are actually part of the project, part of our weekly engineering meeting that we kind of do. And, you know, there are people that come in and support from that side, who are actually working for IBM or working for ARM, you know. And they're contributing on that level where there's constant communication there. So that's where you kind of see some other people that are involved with the project as being, yeah, highly active, but also coming from a different direction or a different company.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me, given the fact that ARM is gaining, I wouldn't say the upper hand, but even apart from this mobile craze about what? 98% of all mobile devices on this planet, I'm guessing now, run ARM processors in some fashion or another. ARM is also very quickly capturing the cloud and the data centers. If you take a look at AWS, if you take a look at HPE's Moonshine, all the rest of them, these are clearly projects aimed at taking away a piece of the cake from Intel when it comes down to mass deployments in terms of beyond mobile. So I reckon that ARM will become even more important in the future, especially now that ARM is also capturing the desktop. I'm using an Apple M1 on a daily basis, and that goes to show, I suppose.
Well, you know, recently I was taking part in the Open Firmware Conference, and, you know, it was really good discussion just listening to them. They were talking about x86, you know, and they're saying that the model's kind of going to have to change there a little bit from that architecture, you know, because you need just that open environment in the hardware space now, because otherwise you're highly at risk, right? So,
pun intended, RISC-V, of course, being the prime example here.
Yeah.
Nice one.
Unless you're Apple, of course, building an M1 chip there.
Well, you see, Martin, even they have to license the SoC designs from ARM. I mean, highly modified, of course, but at the end of the day, that's an ARM architecture. Welcome to the nerd level of this podcast. Anyway, but we are digressing. This is not the ARM podcast, but rather Linux in-laws. There was something else I wanted to ask. Yes, maybe you can shed a little bit of light. I mean, you already talked about the history of the project, but what's the current status with regards to beyond, say, Leap? And the other one was Tumbleweed, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, what's the current status? First of all, I think our flagship is clearly Tumbleweed. Many people use it as daily driver in between. And as well, I just learned that one of the other podcasts, I think it was Destillation Linux or something like that, they set up a server with Tumbleweed and are quite happy with the results so far. Then we have, of course, Leap, which is following the classical release model. So it is a long-term support release because what we're currently seeing is a service pack 15.3 to the original, to the starting Leap 15.0 series. And the service packs will continue until we come to a Leap 16.0. And this goes synchronous with the development of the SUSE Linux Enterprise kernel. In previous times, when we switched from the 12.1, 13.1 to 13.3, the old development model, to the Leap development model, we were sharing the sources with SUSE Linux Enterprise, but they've been built slightly different. And now we did the so-called JUMP project, where we unified the binaries for both series, for the SLE series as well as for the Leap series. So we basically save one. Jetzt fehlen mir gerade mal die Worte. Können wir das rausschneiden?
Well, try me, Axel. I'm known to have a little bit of basic English.
Eine Codelinie sparen wir ein.
You can save a little bit on the coding. On the code I support, let's put it this way.
Yeah, that's true. So we are saving one line of support. We don't have to build for SLE and Leap, but we only build for Sleep and importing the binaries into Leap.
Yeah, So you mentioned the history of the project and it being around a long time. It's actually the second biggest Linux distribution. Is that correct? If I'm mistaken. But it appears to be mainly aimed at the desktop. Is that a fair statement? What would you say?
So the one thing that I could definitely say about OpenSUSE is that really it's built for the. I mean, it's built for the people that are contributing to it, so to speak, in a sense. You know, I mean, you could say it's for the people running servers or desktop, but like, it's. A lot of people that are using it have very particular use cases, right? And so that's why there's so much variety within OpenSUSE. But yeah, I mean, you also have different aspects with like MicroOS and OpenSUSE Cubic. You know, you have people that are running servers with Tumbleweed. You know, but looking at Leap as a server based. I mean, that's also it's kind of one of the reasons why we actually sort of moved to that. Well, we moved to that 1 year release cycle where, you know, there's a few distributions that are still around doing that 6 month release cycle, but people just don't want to be upgrading their servers every 6 months, you know? So really it's kind of hard to say what it's for, but it's really just, you know, people that are contributing it and putting the things in that they need to experiment and test things out and, you know, plan for the future.
Okay, but I mean, Axel, you mentioned that you've been running it since, oh, I can't remember when it was, but...
1980, you said.
1980.
Sorry, 1998.
Ah, okay.
1990. Just before so, Prince came up with that song.
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, the desktop war is, well, war, whatever you want to call it, it's still not been quite wrangled out of the hands of the Microsofts, right?
What desktop war, Martin?
Yeah, exactly. It's not quite a war. I mean, the people that like open source and they develop in open source, they run a Linux desktop, but you know, the mainstream of people running laptops are going to be on Windows still. Do you see that changing? Or there's mention of some German states changing Windows PCs to Linux and stuff like that. Is that something that you see more and more of from your side?
That requires probably another election, but that's besides the point.
I actually look at the analytics quite regularly, like once a week.
Okay.
And so, I mean, you know, you and it also depends where we're talking about in the world, right? Like, because you see certain countries like accelerate more with open source software than France, you do with other countries. So
yes.
So really, it's. I mean, I heard a statistic in the U.S. that more Chrome OS is starting to be used rather than Microsoft. So I mean, those are transitions that take place. And then you look at parts of Africa where you see a lot of countries coming on board there, which is really nice. And then Asia. I mean, like I know that when we look at our when I look at the distribution, basically Germany's number one. U.S. is number two. I believe it would go Brazil, China, Russia, I think. So, you know, and that's basically just capturing mostly just desktop.
You're talking about Leap desktop deployments, yeah. Not Tumbleweed.
It's a mixture of both, actually.
Okay.
I mean, from what I see it, yeah.
The U.S., interesting. I would have thought more like France or Spain or something, not necessarily U.S.
Well, the Europe is really covered, but I mean, you kind of, I think it's the population aspect. This somehow needs to be considered, you know. We have a big following in Indonesia, too. But, I mean, like, Europe primarily, it's just covered where there's a lot of use, you know, Spain as well. I mean, basically all over Europe. But obviously Germany has the highest, like on the map, it's you know, on the heat map, it's the darker color, but the other ones are right there. It's just not
right. I'll be open as well. I run Ubuntu on my laptop, right? So I think would it be fair to say if you want to convince people to? Or if even would you convince people to use OpenSUSE instead, or is it really a matter of choice? Right? What are the benefits of if you know if you were to do a pitch about OpenSUSE, just using that?
I think first of all we would need to convince people that's a good idea to use free software compared to proprietary software.
Yeah.
As long as you can only buy hardware with a pre-installed proprietary system, be it macOS or Windows, it's definitely difficult to convince Jack user or the normal user to use something else because people are lazy. They're just using what they get. They're using what they used to use, and every change is difficult. If it's something new, then people have adapt to it, and it's difficult. If you're used to a Linux machine, for example, and you sit the first time in your life in front of a Mac or in front of a Windows machine, you say, hey, come on, what's that? Huh? Yeah. It's not easy by nature. It's easy because you're using it for a very long time, right? And as long as we cannot convince more hardware manufacturers to come up at least with a pre-installed, ideally free operating system, whether it is Ubuntu, whether it is Fedora, or whether it is OpenSUSE, the life for the free software community will be difficult. That's for sure.
Yeah. So the obvious question is there clearly, why is this not happening yet? I can think of one reason, but I'd like your take on it as well.
My impression is that the manufacturers have contracts with one major software supplier, and I guess he's putting some pressure on them as well. To give you an example, I'm using ThinkPad laptops since the 90s, and I wanted to buy a ThinkPad without pre-installed operating system, and I wrote to the CEO of Lenovo in Germany, and I got a call back from them and saying, oh, no, we're not selling them without Windows. I said, okay, you can sell me one with Windows, but you reimburse the license because I don't use it. No, we're not doing that. I say, can I get this in written? No, of course not. And with this, the discussion was finished. In the end of the day, I get me a ThinkPad without pre-installed operating system, and that was okay. Luckily, we have some smaller manufacturers like Tuxedo, for example, who assemble computers, laptops, as you want them, with the system of your choice installed, and I think that's a good thing. But in mainstream, if you look at the big manufacturers, it hasn't arrived yet. And it's not because it's difficult. It's just the marketing and contracts and I don't know what.
Tuxedo, if you're listening, the email is a sponsor at linuxinlaws.eu. Yeah. On that same note, I'm almost tempted to add, yes, you can get Linux-based laptops from Dell too. Mm-hmm. Because but I bought one ages ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, the one reason for is around the adoption is clearly things like availability of gaming software, right? Windows is known for that as the platform for where most games come out on. So unless you're on a console, so that kind of, unless that changes, you're not going to convince that market to change to
Martin, don't forget SteamOS.
Yeah, fair enough. Have you tried it? Does it work?
Well, their operating system is based on Linux, and if figures are anything to go by, they have a fair share of market capture.
Hmm. Yeah, but it's most apart from Windows. most games come out on Windows first, right? That's still the case, unless it's on the console, as I mentioned. So, and this is when the younger generation are growing up with Windows, and as you say, it's hard to change. So. Then it becomes a harder battle. But
and even worse, the pupils and students are forced to use Microsoft products in the universities, this is the real scandal behind it, I think.
Now, is that
really? You asked before that whether this will change maybe in the public sector, and I think now we really have for the first time the chance that there is something changing. Because Schleswig-Holstein is pushing for it, for example. And even in Lower Saxony, where they were supposed to bin about 12,000 Linux-based installations in favor for Microsoft Windows, it seems that the train is not really gone. There may even be a chance with the change of the political leadership in there.
So, people, forget about this coronavirus thing. Just go to the streets for open source software. Very important. You heard it here first. On a way more serious note, Axel, yes, you have a point. But on the other side, I'm almost tempted to say, who cares about the desktop anymore? More and more things are moving to the cloud. And you already mentioned Chromebooks. And if I take a look at the numbers of these units being sold, especially in the mass markets like US and so forth, this is staggering because all they need is an internet connection and the rest is done more or less in the cloud. And on these Chromebooks normally run something called, normally something called Chrome Runs, which essentially is an, I'm always tempted to say open core project because Chromium is an open source code base. So at the end of the day, all you need is basically a bootloader called Linux and some sort of browser that allows you to do your work in the cloud at the end of the day.
So I guess, was it Shells? Was it shells.com had that? That's sort of an aspect, which is quite interesting. We had worked with them. A lot of distributions actually worked with them as a cloud-based operating system. But yeah, I mean, you're right. A lot more workloads are moving to the cloud, and we do have something like MicroOS that actually would work for that. I mean, kind of designed for that type of thing. OpenSUSE has a very diverse set of projects within it. You know, I guess when we talked about earlier, you know, when you asked what is OpenSUSE, I mean, really it's a project full of projects, and you know, there's so many different things you can find within it, within OpenSUSE, and things that you can build. And you know, we have options to do that. You want to expand any more on that, Axel?
Please do.
Not sure where to pick up now. Yes, I mean, these cloud models or Chromebook models, they work for a certain use case. But if I look at myself, I mean, I'm mostly not working on a command line. That happens every now and then. But I'm using a regular desktop. I'm using a tablet, for example, but I feel these tablets are very limited with what you can do with it, except reading emails and watching movies or something like that. So if you really have a job to do, I think there is no way around having a locally running a laptop. With cloud, you always have to be confident that the individual or the company that you're sharing your data with is trustworthy enough. Because especially a cloud is very attractive for attackers. So I guess it's not the question if, but the question when your preferred cloud supplier will be hacked.
We are now entering the philosophical / IT security part of the podcast, of this episode anyway. Jokes aside. I get the security angle, but if I take a look at the generation after us, the question begs, do they really care? They're all on the Android devices, they're all on the Chromebooks, and they're all in the cloud. This is a cloud native generation, I suppose. I'm digressing from OpenSUSE, but regardless.
Exactly.
I mean, they're still the makers, the people that want to create, right? I mean, we have one of the guys in our project, you know, he's like 16, and he hops in, you know, and actually there's a lot of people who are, you know, sending him down the right path of learning these things. But it's not going to go away, you know, you're going to have people that are always interested in that. Now, does it become mainstream? I mean, I don't think so, but there's always a need. You need something to develop on. And you could be right where people don't necessarily care about it, but that's the thing, right? You don't care about it until something happens to you, you know, or until you get the message. So,
absolutely, I go to Gugomer, Martin. But you had a thought as well.
Well, I mean, to finish that discussion, yes, your developer is not going to be running on a Chromebook, right? It's they're on their Apple MacBooks drinking their lattes and what have you. But
I'm on an Apple MacBook and normally drinking beer, but that's beside the point.
Depending what time of day it is. Yeah. Mind you, in your case, probably doesn't matter.
Let's move on to safer ground.
Yeah.
Okay, where do you see this or these projects rather? Because OpenSUSE, as we just learned, is an umbrella for all projects, for quite some few projects. Where do you see this going?
Hang on, I need to polish my crystal ball a little bit. Good question. I hope we're attracting many more people. We are growing a base of happy users as we did it in the last year. Doug, correct me if I'm wrong, but if I'm looking at metrics.o.0, I think we've nearly doubled the amount of users during the last year. Can that be?
Yeah, that is, I mean... You all could view it on matrix.opensuse.org, but yeah, basically it has gone up. I do know that there was some counting figures that weren't happening correctly, but at least that's what I heard. But yeah, it has gone up a significant amount. Some of that I think had to do a little bit with perhaps the timing or so of the CentOS announcement, but you know, on the other hand, they're you know, Tumbleweed wouldn't necessarily be in that category, but we've seen jumps in Leap, and we've seen jumps in Tumbleweed as well.
Doug, sorry, for those one listener who out there who does not know what the CentOS debacle is, maybe you want to explain a little bit.
Well, I mean,
what happened?
I mean, I could, but you know, you could definitely. I mean, we have good relationships with the CentOS community, you know. So basically, you know, there was an announcement where they're sort of shifting the way they're going about producing, CentOS, and they're changing it more to CentOS Stream, which is sort of like, you could say, a rolling development, but very conservative, I think, rolling development toward RHEL. So that's my understanding of it. And of course, you know, there were a lot of different forks based on that announcement. You have Rocky Linux, Alma, and then of course a lot of people really transitioned to OpenSUSE Leap as well. So I mean, like that. If I'm missing anything, please feel free to add.
Some people told me essentially Red Hat, after the acquisition by IBM, broke their promise in terms of CentOS, basically following the code base of Red Hat and making sure that the quality levels stay the same, and also release cadence stay the same. Apparently that, and of course, the duration of support that you would get with a CentOS release was shrunk, and hence this stream thing. And that was what I'm looking for, somewhat made a few people, in order to avoid the term annoyed, made them reconsider their choice of operating system in terms of Linux enterprise distribution. And that's probably the thing, basically, that you saw when quite a few people jumped over to OpenSUSE. Because at the end of the day, if I understand this correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, OpenSUSE follows the code base of something called SUSE Linux Enterprise System, also known as LES.
Yeah, I mean, it is fully compatible. I mean, it's built from the sources and the binaries, Leap is. And so, you know, it took some years to do that. And, you know, Axel kind of explained that a little bit earlier. But basically, we'd been working in that direction as much as possible. And now we got it down to basically where it needs to be to literally, my understanding, I haven't done it myself, but, you know, if you wanted to go from Leap to the enterprise, SUSE Linux Enterprise, you know, it's basically the branding packages that you switch over and you're right there. So it takes like 20 seconds or something like that, as opposed to the other, you know, what it was in the past. But we'd always been working in that direction, you know, from the 42 series. The 15 series showed a lot more promise. The 42 series was in itself a movement, right? It was, well, hey, let's do this. And then 15 kind of got closer. And then ultimately, like, yeah, 15.3 was the one that really was the game changer. And so we're looking at coming out with 15.4 sometime in, we'll say, early summer, around the time of the OpenSUSE conference, which should be in June-ish timeframe, and then guaranteed also that we'll be having a 15.5. And so overall, if you look at the 15 series, I mean, it's, I think, it's on the roadmap, or actually, I think it's like on the wiki where it's talking about the life series or the life cycle of Leap. And it's, you know, it's no successor has been named yet. And the way that Leap works is basically once a new version comes out, the old version will run for another 6 months. So basically, you're looking at minor versions running roughly 18 months, you know, and the major versions are, you know, well past 72 months. I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of like in the 80s or 90s amount of months.
Yes. You mentioned the conference. You want to plug it in terms of what it is and who should attend?
Well, actually, yeah, sure. That, you know, that's, we have the call for papers. It just opened up. We're planning to go for a physical conference in Nuremberg. We do it at the Zetbau in Nuremberg, and people that would, we would like to submit talks could be anyone in the open source community. You know, we have a certain tracks dealing with new technologies, you know, OpenSUSE tracks, community tracks, cloud and container tracks. But, you know, people that we would like to see come are like basically all the distros, right? Like, you know, if you have something you want to share with the community, I mean, it's a great opportunity. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with SoftIron, the ARM servers that came out, like, it was a while back. You know, they basically sort of test piloted their talk, because they had to talk with Red Hat, but they test piloted with us and announced the release of their ARM server at our conference. And I mean, like, those are the things, like, we would really like just people to, like, participate. And I know we've had people from Ubuntu come, Red Hat, Fedora, Debian, just a variety of different people.
So you just mentioned Debian. So it's more like a DebConf, where you can submit pretty much anything as long as it's of interest for the open source community. It doesn't have to be distribution related.
No, it doesn't.
So if Martin wants to submit his proposal on quantum computing on an ARM chip as an emulator, that's the place to do it.
Absolutely. I mean,
Martin, you heard it here first. Go ahead.
Yeah, how much time have we got there?
And it would be even better if he brings the demo system along.
Sufficient cooling facilities.
Martin has been working on that for the last 20 years, but that's another story. Right. Anyway.
Still quite finished yet.
Exactly. Cooling can be an issue. So it's either quantum computing or cold beer. Huh?
Can you provide zero Kelvin, I wonder? At the conference.
Doug just mentioned cloud computing, containers and something like that. Maybe we should briefly talk about two quite new developments in the OpenSUSE world, and this is MicroOS and Cubic. MicroOS is a minimalistic, self-contained, transactional system which technically is based on Tumbleweed. So minimalistic means it comes when you install it with a very small set of software. Transactional means that it runs from a read-only file system. It makes use of the ButterFS file system. And once you apply an update, which the system does automatically, it checks the update. And if the update is okay, it requires a reboot, and then it runs from the new slice, so from the new read-only file system. If it's not okay, it rolls back automatically. And the intention for that was originally for edge computing and something like that. But as the people are quite creative, they started using it as a desktop environment. So as such, you can install all the packages that you get from Tumbleweed, for example. I think we're shipping some 15,000 to 18,000 programs. Or you can also use Flatpak, for example, or app images on it. And MicroOS combined with Kubernetes as management for large computer, large container deployments is Kubic. So it's technically the same basis as MicroOS. And I think you mentioned that briefly in the beginning of our talk. There is, since sometimes, a project working on a MicroOS based on Leap. And I think that is about to be released in one of the coming weeks. Doug, do you know more?
I don't recall the exact time frame, but I know. So we had it at the community meeting where Lubosch was discussing it, and they were supposed to have a beta coming up soon. Actually, it should come up very soon, since we're actually getting close to the beta cycle of Leap anyway. So I would expect it to come out.
Just wondering if you're clearly targeting this more and more at the enterprise or kind of zero downtime community, are there any plans, if you still have to reboot the kernel after an update, are there any plans for technology similar to Kpatch or Kgraft in that regard? As in, basically, you can patch the kernel and then do no reboot. You simply basically let the system work on, as in run on, as in live patching. Any plans? I mean, the reason why I'm asking this is quite straightforward, because if you're targeting the container ecosystem, you're targeting automatically more or less the data center as an enterprise-grade deployments. And there, typically, change windows tend to be really small, if at all.
I mean, I'm not quite certain, but when you update MicroOS, I don't think it like you need an automatic reboot. It's just when it does reboot, it goes into that new one. Is that correct, Axel?
No, it needs a reboot because, as I said, it runs from a read-only file system. The change is applied basically in new snapshot, and then you need to activate the snapshot somehow.
Okay.
So that has nothing to do with kernel live patching or something like that. Which is, I think, available for SLE, and I have to admit, I didn't look into it. I don't know whether it would be available on Leap or something like that as well.
But the understanding, right, is that if you're looking at cloud computing and things of that nature, like, isn't sort of just throwing, I mean, if you're running a bunch of containers or whatnot, like, it's not like all that important, you know, because you have the container orchestration, you'll be using a variety of different machines. So it's just a matter of, you know, how you do that, right? With maybe some sort of configuration management tool, which also, like, if you look at UUni, which is another sort of project as well that kind of falls in the OpenSUSE spectrum a little bit.
Interesting. And these two developments came out of the Rancher acquisition.
No, it was before Rancher.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, way before. Yeah.
So, what are the plans for the Rancher technology that the acquisition brought into the game? If you can talk about it.
I think you need to ask SUSE about that. It's nothing of the SUSE community.
Yeah. I mean, I really, to be honest, I don't know. I don't know.
Fair enough.
I'm I'm here for OpenSUSE, and that's really kind of what I...
But the Rancher codebase was open source too, if I remember correctly, right?
Yes, yes. I mean, they have a lot of users, and those users apparently, you know, are the user base becomes the customer base, right? So I mean, I'm not, they've been around a while. I know we bumped into them before the acquisition happened. And I mean, OpenSUSE itself, like, we work with them because we do the Google Summer of Code. And, you know, we obviously reached out to them to see if they wanted to participate. They weren't aware of it. They were part of our Google Summer of Code last year, but it was just a matter of, like, you know, just supporting them administratively from the OpenSUSE side.
Yeah, I mean, containers are a different beast anyway. You just have to take a look at the OpenShift. Native Kubernetes, of course, comes to mind. The likes of Swarm that have clearly died, more or less. Well, Docker itself is at a disposal, I suppose, in terms of what's going to happen to the future. They sold their enterprise assets to something called Mirantis. And I think the Docker desktop thing probably might be a stillborn long term. So it remains to be seen. But the juice is really actually on the enterprise level in terms of having orchestration frameworks such as OpenShift that really drives a couple of million vCores in a data center or data centers across the globe in containers. Rumor has it that if you type a search query into Google, it runs in its own container. And given the fact that at least 4 or 5 people on any given day use Google as their main search, and that's quite a few. It may be more than 4 people.
So it sounds like Cubic is a bit of an alternative for OpenShift, right, on your side. Would you agree with that? Does it do more or less than OpenShift?
Any thoughts on this?
I know that they work together, but Axel, if you have anything to...
No, that's not in my area of expertise. I can't comment on that.
So Vikas probably won't be in the show notes. No, I'm joking.
I mean, I'm not so familiar with it, but I know that there's a lot of cross collaboration there just based on the packages that are involved, right? So, like, you know, but you have I believe Cryo is one of the packages that might be across for both of them, Podman, things like that.
Exactly. As far as I know, basically they are all OCI compliant as an open container initiative, and that's the API definition. Cryo probably being the best example, as in the container runtime.
Yeah.
That Docker open sourced at some stage.
Yeah.
But this brings us neatly to the end of the container section of this podcast. Guys, before we close this off, any final thoughts, especially from a community perspective? So are you still looking for hands on the ground or feet on the ground, whatever you want to call it, in terms of people joining the project? If so, what are you looking for?
What are we looking for? I think we can make use of hands in any areas, be it documentation, be it moderation of our discussion channels. Our website could need a refresh as well. I think we're not looking for something specific, but we welcome any kind of contribution. No, one of our community members said once, OpenSUSE is a duocracy. That means those who do decide. So if you have a good idea and you want to bring it onto OpenSUSE, feel free to do so as long as you're staying within the guidelines. Then you can basically do anything that you like to do. Except, of course, things that are related to proprietary code, especially codecs or something like that, which we do not allow on our infrastructure.
So, Martin, just wondering, is that D-Wave 2X thing that you keep talking about, is that proprietary in nature? If not, just go ahead and do that quantum computing port.
I'll think about it for the talk. Yeah, good plan.
Perfect.
I'd like to follow on to the board members' talk. Is that also, like, you know, governance is the big thing, right? Like, these things, we just had our OpenSUSE board elections. And I mean, you know, these things are relatively important. We hope that people do get involved and participate in the governance aspect. Contributing in all other facets of OpenSUSE or open source is great, but, you know, there is that aspect of governance that it needs to exist in order for the whole system to function. So,
Doug, what type of people are you looking for in that case?
Well, you know, basically just someone that is willing to, you know, do kind of what Axel does. You know, you're an ambassador. You take part in the project. You're heavily involved. You mediate. You deconflict things. I mean, there are certain qualities that you know, we all have, and some are better at things than others. And I think that from a governance side, you need people that can lead, whether that's talking to the media, whether that's, you know, reaching out to someone who might have an issue with another person in a project that maybe where conflict exists, and they have the right skills to, you know, make two people come together or solve their problems in a fashion that's not confrontational. So
that goes from people like myself who cannot stop talking at all, or to a lesser extent, right up to technical people who can solve code bases conflicts.
Yes.
Or people who run our infrastructures. We have the Heroes team, for example, who is managing all the OpenSUSE infrastructure, mail server, forums, and so on and so on.
People, you heard it first. If you're looking for an interesting hobby, who should they send mail to?
Well, I would say probably check out list.opensuse.org.
The URL and will be in the show notes, yes.
There'll be, you know, there's a lot of different projects within that. And so you could find it. Or the simple solution is just to email opensuse-project@opensuse.org.
But that email address, yes, will be certain in the show notes.
You have to subscribe, though, so.
No, no problem. And is there a website that people could check out before subscribing to that mailing list, I wonder? For the people who do not know what email is, there might be the one, two, or three out there. I don't know.
Or a fax. I would say they could go to get.opensuse.org or opensuse.org. Those are some key options. There are a variety of different email or a variety of different websites we have. You know, we have forums, we have social media, we have a variety of different channels that people can reach out. You can go to simply chat.opensuse.org if you want to talk to someone. And got to give the bar a plug. We actually started a bar, a virtual bar. You can go there now if you want, but it would be meet.opensuse.org/bar, and there'll be people hanging out in there, chatting. And I mean, that's a good entry point for
That's a good idea, Doug. This is really a nice thing. It started a little bit more than a year ago, and usually you find always somebody there from all over the world, and that makes it really interesting.
Bar. Martin, that's probably virtual something bar. We should probably think about following those in-laws. On a totally different note, for people like Martin and myself, as in the dinosaurs in the community, do you run an IRC channel or something like this for OpenSUSE?
Yes, we also have an IRC channel or multiple IRC channels.
Perfect.
Where usually the developers and so on hang around.
The details will be on opensuse.org.
Not for the IRC stuff.
Okay.
It's actually on the wiki. But I'll send you a copy
please,
of that.
Yeah, please do, so that I can. I mean, if the wiki, of course, if the wiki is public, if it's not, don't bother.
It is
perfect. Anything that you want to mention before we close up the show?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Giving us an opportunity to talk about OpenSUSE and open source.
Anytime, because at the end of the day, OpenSUSE relates to SUSE, and SUSE, of course, is a German company. That makes it a communist cooperative. Simple as that.
And not to forget, we cooperate with the communists around the world.
There you go.
Good friends from Debian and the other communities.
Guys, jokes aside, that has been more than a pleasure. Martin, you want to do the honors?
Yeah, thank you very much, guys. It's been a real pleasure, and great to hear about OpenSUSE.
And thank you.
Go and try out myself.
Yeah, thanks for having us here. And if you cannot decide where to start with OpenSUSE, just download Tumbleweed with the KDE desktop. We have 10 more desktops to install. You don't need a second distribution for that, like a K, an X, or an L, and you know what's coming afterwards. Just give it a try.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And it has been a pleasure.
This is the Linux In-Laws.
You come for the knowledge,
but stay for the madness.
Thank you for listening.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts. Martin, for obvious reasons, may be tricky for Martin to enter that kind of a proposal for that quantum thing, because as you probably know, Britain is no longer a part of the European Union, and there's this pandemic thing.
There might be some paperwork in.
Yes, but let me see what I can do about this. So you're actually living in Bamberg, Connecticut, and not Bamberg, Bavaria. I see.
I live in my own world, I guess.
Just checking. No. I mean, I would really like to see you again, because it's been a while since. I mean, we last met, I think, in St. Augustine, if I'm not completely mistaken, as in Frostcon. And that's at least 3 years back, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it was probably the one I got my ticket on the way back.
Okay. Now it's nicely framed in your living room, right?
I get one per year for some reason. They always get me.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR is kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.